Are you sure you want to stay here? It looks creepy.
But Savannah, this is the House of Mystery. Let's see, the brochure says true crime, conspiracy, alternate history, all rooms right here in the house.
I don't know, which room is ours?
Yes, this may be our room. Oh, well, sorry, ma'am. Obviously, this is not our room.
Ah, here's our room. True crime.
You've now entered the House of Mystery on KYAH. Utah's Talk Authority with your hosts, Al Warren and Kev Thompson. Also, Julie Saville with the Paranormal Report. The True Crime Commentary by Stephen David Lampley. And Dr. Joseph Usensky's Conspiracy Countdown.
You've tuned into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren, broadcasting from KKNW 1150 AM Seattle.
And this is Kev Thompson, broadcasting from WXEI, the talk of Crestview, Florida.
And I am Julie Saville, and I am broadcasting from the UK.
Okay. Now, today we've got another special guest. It's been quite a lineup this day. So we're going to jump right into the guest. And after the guest, we have Joe Usensky coming in with his conspiracy countdown. And we also have Stephen David Lampley doing his ballistics report, part two. So joining us today is, he needs no introduction. No, he's been here before. Robbie Thomas, who's got a new book out, and he's the psychic detective. Thank you for being here, Rob.
No, thank you for having me back. Thank you.
Anytime. We enjoy having you.
I love being here.
So, this is exciting. You've got a new book coming out. What's it all about? What's going on with the new book?
Yeah, the new book, it's taken me quite some time to get this finally out the door. I would say roughly 8 years out the door. Every time I go to bring this body of work out, it's always another case, finding somebody alive, solving another murder case. So I just kept putting that in the back burner, adding it to the book. And then you got so much, which turned out to be almost a 400-page book, so I cut it down to size so that it would be not too boring case after case. And we're roughly about 235 pages now. The book itself details with astronomical amount of documentation for each case. We have text messages, we have emails that went back and forth between detectives and myself. Families, there's testimonial letters from each detective in cases and families as well. And then there's news clips, photos of being on the front lines with different detectives. There's some photos in the book with America's Most Wanted film crew who filmed me for my pilot series, Psychic Profiler, after the same book. And I just put it all together, finally getting this thing out of the can, and showing to people that psychic ability and psychic profilers do work with all levels of law enforcement internationally with proven facts of solving the cases and bringing people home alive.
We've had quite a few interviews lately, Robbie, with many different theories about how we receive information as mediums and where we receive, the source of that information. What's your view?
My faith is Lord Jesus Christ. And one good example of this is when I was in Virginia filming the paranormal show that I was involved with last year, we came along the 17th of November, arriving in Virginia. I get a text message of a lady in my hometown saying her husband's brain dead and that the doctors wanted to take him off life support. Could I come and help her? And I said, I just landed in Virginia. Could they please hang tough and I can come there? So somehow she persuaded the neurological team in the ICU unit to hang tough, not to unplug him. And I made it back on Tuesday. I drove straight through, got a car with my wife, and we drove straight through 12 hours. I get back to the hospital, and I never seen an individual like this in my life. He looked like a machine. He had tubes coming out of the side of his ribs. He had three IVs. He had tubes in his mouth. He was literally all hooked up to everything. I just took my hat off and started to pray. And I asked God, I said, you know, please let him converse with me and find some meaning to this. What's wrong? Then I started hearing neurological toxicity. I heard they're killing me. I heard my brain is swelling. I heard it's going to take time to heal. I turned to the wife and she said, oh no, it's not good. And I said, no. And I hugged her and I explained to her first before looking at the doctors and whatever there. And I told her exactly what I just told you. And I left because now the meeting's starting. I get a text message from her about an hour and a bit later. And she says, the ICU unit is up in arms. Everybody's running around trying to explain to her the mistake that they made. And I said, what did you mean? And then the letter in the book, she writes how it step by step went down, that they actually were giving him the wrong medicine. They were killing him. And the answers I got were from God, through Bill, the gentleman who laid in bed dead.
So you don't have a guide or an intermediary or?
Yeah, I have guides and angels, but my main two individual to go to, I always pray to Jesus, always. And I ask for guidance in that relation, that if there is any information that can come through from whomever is on the other side or beside me or with me, please let it happen. And in this instance, it did. It happened. It was Bill's spirit that was coming towards and telling me these things. I could hear him auto from the audio and just staring at him visually. You can see that his eyes were open, but he wasn't there. He was brain dead. Today, Bill, 2 months later, Bill's at home. He's alive and he's eating. He can't walk yet because of the brain swelling, but they beat the doctors. They didn't unplug him and, God saved them.
Amazing story.
Now, many people have psychic abilities or, you know, paranormal abilities, and oftentimes they find it very, very difficult to come to grips with this. Knowing you, Robbie, you discovered your abilities early on in your late teens. When did you know that this was going to be your purpose?
Yeah, good question. The switch that really hit me was in my late teens when I went to become a police officer at age 17. And then later on in my 20s, when I was hired when I was 17, I did the police testing and I was fired the same day because you had to be 20 years of age to be an auxiliary. And I beat out 100 individuals for all this strength testing, psychological testing, what have you. But I pursued this later on and became a police officer in my early 20s. Now, my adolescent, early childhood, and communicating with spirit, it was more of a learning phase, learning how to cooperate and listen and see what was happening. It was more of an essence of letting it soak in and trying to find myself. Now, if I would have told that to my peer section, you know, I would have been crushed. I mean, people would have thought I was nuts and what have you. But come full circle up into the teenage area in adolescent time, 20 years of age, that's when I knew. And when I was hired on as a police officer and there was an individual that was dead and I was giving CPR to, I heard him say, let me go. I stepped back for a moment and then I went back to doing vitals and then checking and then going to do CPR one more time. And I heard him say, let me go, real loud. So I quit. And in doing so, when you're a police officer, you just don't quit. They just don't let you say, okay, you know, it's not like a job. You just quit. So they wanted to know why. They sent down a film crew. They sent down a captain and a sergeant. And they came into my home, and they wanted this on film. And they were making a movie called as a working tool for EMTs, firefighters, and police officers who quit under duress. But I wasn't stressed out. What was the problem was I just knew I was going to do something different than become a police officer and work with law enforcement in that parameter. So here we are. We're talking on film, and they came to that magical question, why I wanted to quit. And when I explained to them about the individual in that room who was dead, you know, and what was going on, and I heard him say, let me go, you should have seen their faces. I mean, they were just stunned. But that's the truth of the matter, and I, you know, you got to follow your truth, and I did.
Has your relationships with your colleagues changed over the years, Robbie?
My colleague or my colleagues?
Colleagues, so people from the police, friends. Have they changed
yeah.
the result of your beliefs and your and what you the work that you do?
Yeah, you know, Julie, it has transformed and really turned a 360. In the beginning, it was very difficult. But as time went on, and one case got solved, another got solved, and then pretty soon word got out, it just became, we can call him, we can email him, or what have you, and I would answer the call. And that's been like, so now I look at it in today's day, it's so easy. But back then, it was a hard transgression turning that corner, but it made it. And we're looking at 28 years from my very first case, 28 years, and it was a long walk. So colleagues look at this and say, you know, it's something different, but yeah, we can trust him. I've spoken at many conventions, which Kevin has seen me at, and I consider him a colleague, and I'm sure if something ever arises, he would give me a call. I'd be there for him, and, you know, no questions asked. So when I look at different law enforcement throughout the United States, internationally even, it's I think it's a good thing, because then it's not that it's just me. We're a team, and it makes law enforcement agencies look at this whole demographic of psychic abilities and people who have this ability that they can possibly rely on another individual.
So how does a person take that first step in gaining credibility with law enforcement?
Yeah, it's a big step. And I tell everybody on every show I do, please do not put yourself in the stupidity I did my very first case. When I was sitting beside the murderer and he confessed to me how he shot and killed Mark Campbell along with his cohort, you know, he grabbed me and he checked me for a wire. And then he told me afterwards, after he questioned me, that, you know, I'm going to kill you. You know, you don't put yourself in those positions. That was something that was really naive of me. And very not smart whatsoever. But as you get on in doing the cases and the police know who you are, it's the solving, the actual giving of the perception of a different part of evidence that they can move forward on even, or finding somebody alive. And then they can say, wow, it really is true. He is doing this. And over the course of the years, the many, many years, I've learned one good thing. And a good psychic profiler will do this. You'll keep every piece of documentation you ever get from a police officer. You'll ask them ahead of time that you want something in credentials that you'll show that you do this work. You speak with the families. And when you do good and it comes from the heart and you prove your point, you get that. They're more than willing to give it to you. Law enforcement, do not hesitate to endorse somebody who is actually able to do this for real.
And in terms of justice and the, you know, obviously, because I'm in the UK and, you know, the laws and the way things are done are very different. But in terms of the kind of mediumship, the psychic influence on a case, how do you cannot go into a court of law and say, well, I had a vision or I you know, we went to a medium and this is what they said. So you have to come up with hard evidence, don't you, Robbie?
Yeah, you do, Julie. You have to come up with something that's very substantial and evidential. So when you, being the police officer, come to me and we go through the motion of a double homicide, and I find the knife that stabbed and gutted two individuals, and then we find out that one individual that I'm speaking with, and I'm holding the recording, and this is part of a story that's actually in the book, and he confesses to me under the tape, that's hardcore evidence. And now they can't say the psychic did this, but you are the working tool. So it gives the blue line that substantial piece of tool or evidence that they can take for themselves and say, we obtain this by our investigation. And it stays at that point. It doesn't include the psychic. You are the tool. But on the other end now, the flip coin, we look at it this way. After the case is done, they give you all the credential and say, yes, we've done this. He's the person or she's the person that helped us. And you get that as your backing. One day, the courts are going to recognize that the ability of someone like myself can walk into a case, sit down and profile two people who have murdered a little girl and show where the body is, and then they arrest those two people and find the body, that's going to be evidence. You will become the evidence. That will be coming because the documentation, the actual ability that is without a doubt proof, the writing is on the wall, they have to use that as evidence. And in turn, you might have the other side or the defending lawyer say, well, we can't because it's circumstantial. How did he not get the name of that individual who murdered that four-year-old boy? How did he not find that little boy's body being thousands of miles away in a different country? This has to come to play in court. It will sooner or later.
Have you ever had somebody say, well, actually, you know too much, so you must be, you've got to be a suspect?
Good question. Kevin did that to me. No, just kidding. I did a case that
Kevin's got to work first before he could do that.
Yeah. That's right. Kevin's going to put me in jail. A Mount Rainier. There was an individual, a friend of mine, who's works with the DOE Network, Missing People. And he called me up and said, my brother-in-law's daughter was murdered. We need help. I said, okay, just point me in the right way to the detective, and you call him first. So he did. The detective called me back, and he says, I'm going to give you, like, 5 minutes of my time. This guy was really strong-headed and bullheaded and, you know, narrow-minded, if you will, at the prospect of a psychic profiler jumping in on this case. He says, if whatever you send me, if it's any good, I'll call you back. I said, okay. So I did my drawings. I spent time on what I was doing. I gathered up my evidence, what I seen, looking through the photograph of the little girl that was murdered. I faxed it off to him, and I thought, I didn't hear anything back for about 5 minutes. You're not going to call me. The phone rang. He's on the other end of the line, and he's irate. And he's like, how much information did they tell you? And how did you know that this was the guy that you drew that I already have in prison right now? And he's going on and on and on and on and on. He was like putting me on the spot like I was there. And I said, no. Tommy works for the DOE Network. I'm in Canada. He sent me this. And, you know, I have all the documentation through email. I can prove I'm home here. IP address, I'm home here answering this stuff. So I have no idea what you're, you know, about this case. And, you know, that's one scenario of what you're trying to get to. It's very difficult at times when you get on the front lines, even being in person, which I was in Washington on two different separate murder cases down there. I get off the plane and Ronald Reagan Airport, went into the DSA's office. And then there's all the detectives and what have you. And it's like Fort Knox in there. I mean, they check you over and over. You're going through everything just to get into the federal bureau office. And so here we are. And I'm looking at suspect A, and I'm looking at certain file material. And then he goes, here's the map of Maryland, which is part of Virginia, Washington, D.C. And he goes, find her. And that's all I had to go on. And so that was the end of the meeting. I'm a little upset. I just flew all these hours to come down here. They take me back to my hotel room, my wife and I. I take my wife on every death scene. And so then we get to the hotel room. I'm upset not at the individuals. I'm upset at the situation because you got all these fine, beautiful people trying to find resolve for a family. It was a CIA individual's daughter who was murdered. So we got the CIA involved. We got NSA who actually, and you know what? These people don't work with psychics, but they were on the death scene when I was there. I, mind you, the NSA guy didn't say two words to me. He never did talk. He's all, you know, numbers and whatever. I don't know how they work. But we're walking and doing all the diagrams while we're on scene. And then I hand him the map to the DSA, the head detective, Homer. Homer looks at it. He looks right at me and he goes, you know, out of everywhere, that's the only road I was looking at too. And it's a short road. Now I'm in Canada. In my notes, I write down dumping ground, I outlined the road, how it looked, and near Air Force. And sure enough, it was near Andrews Air Force Base. You drive on that road, Julie, and there's mattresses, there's people's TVs. It's a short little road off of Highway 4, way back in, and it's like a dumping ground. And sure enough, we went through all the footing of everything. Homer decides, I'm going to take him for a car ride. Try it off to see if I'm, you know, just playing games or, you know, see if I'm going to second guess myself. I drove all over Maryland with this guy. And he's like, is this it? Is this it? Is this the place? I said, nope. I don't know. And I caught on to this game about 5 minutes in. And I let him do his thing. It was a nice little car ride. I got to see Maryland for a while. And then I looked at Homer, and he appreciated this. Believe me, he really did. And I said, you can take me back to the road now. I'm tired of being in the car. And he just laughed. And we went all the way back to the road. We knew right exactly where we were. We brought the dog teams out. We found a bag that had certain items in this bag that pertained to what was missing from her and him. The phones pinged off the towers, which put on that road, which I did not know. That's what made Homer so like, wow, you picked that little road. And a year to the very day, I get a phone call from the mom who's in CIA. And she says, they found her. I thought, oh my gosh, great. And it's the very day, a year to the very day. And she goes, Homer's doing dental work to find out because the body decayed. And she'll get back to me in a few days. So I'm waiting and waiting. The phone call comes. And she goes, you described a girl wrapped in a blanket 100 feet from the road. And she goes, you know what? You found somebody else's baby, not mine.
Oh.
Now, that's one in a million shot. But I look at it this way. Spirit on the other side. And I know Julie can understand this. Spirit on the other side. Sometimes don't want to be found at that moment, but they're going to help somebody else. And they're going to find somebody else's family member. And that happened. It was just amazing how that took place. It was exactly how I described it and exactly where the body was.
Why is that, Robbie? Why would a spirit not want to be found but locate somebody else for you?
Now, you remember now. Living here is but 5 minutes only in heaven. And it's a blink of an eye. So when we say we live a lifetime here, it's not that long. It really is not that long. So when I say to people, love life, love people, everybody, because everybody needs to have love. Do it because our short life is here. On the other side, they're watching out for us. So unselfishly, Kathleen made me find this other family's baby. And you know what? Hats off to her. Because sooner or later, she's going to be found. The monster who murdered her, here's the difficulty, and I know you can attest to this, Kevin. When a body goes missing, or a person goes missing from one county, but her phone pings in another county, you can't arrest the individual because without murder without a body, because it shows that she went missing in a different county, not the county that they want to get her for. So that's the law in Maryland, and it was very difficult. I couldn't wrap my head around it. If you're in Canada, they arrest you regardless if you went missing in the province over or whatever, but in America, it's really different, the laws. And so I said, okay, I chalked it up to that's the law in Maryland, and we'll go with it. But we're still going to go after this guy. We're going to get him. And that's where we are right now with that case. He knows it. He knows we're on to him. And his time is very, very little left. As we left that case and where it is with all the evidence that we got and what have you, they're getting a warrant for him for something. I forget what they mentioned it was. But his time is very limited. Mm-hmm.
Now, I'd like to kind of revisit Julie's earlier question. I understand from what you've said that you receive your information, from God or from Jesus or sometimes right. from the Spirit.
Right.
But as they hand you that map and that photograph and they sit you down and say, okay, find her, like you said, how does the information present itself to you? I mean, what are the mechanics of what you're doing?
Well, the mechanics of that day was, and I'll be honest, when we got to the hotel room, I was so upset, like I said, at the whole situation, coming off that long flight, being handed a map, them being at a loss. I opened a beer up. I took a big drink of a beer. I put the beer down. I'm very irate. I look at the map, and it was like tunnel vision. And I wasn't focusing on any particular spirit or God or anybody. I was focusing on how angry I was and how I was so center-focused on looking at, that's all they gave me was a map. You know what I mean? It was like an empty, here you go. And I just took the pen, and I circled that little tiny road, and I threw the map down, and my wife goes, you're not done, are you? And I said, yeah, I'm done. And that was my evening. It was just being drawn to it. Now, where you say, where did that come from, God or spirit? Who pointed you that road? I can't answer that because I was so focused on being angry, and I just did it.
Would you say that maybe the intensity of that emotion maybe changed your energy?
Oh, I wouldn't doubt that. I mean, I became tunnel vision. I clued out everything around me, so I didn't know what was around me, and it was just focused straight on that road. What I described in my head on paper prior to leaving was running through my brain really quick, and it was just, I could see it, so I just circled the road.
Wow. I mean, we could roll dice all day long looking for snake eyes and not hit it, but you hit it within a few minutes. I mean, to me, that is just amazing. I would like to attribute my abilities to the beer, but
yeah,
PBR
is good.
Probably
was.
So
but, I look at it this way, and as we go into the book about the lady who went missing, here's another great example for you guys. I'm sitting down in my home. I get a phone call from law enforcement officer Andy DeLay. I did a double homicide with him in Kentucky once. And so he called me back again for a repeat case, but he's in Florida in Kenneth City Police Department. And he says, the BOLO went out at 9:30, Robbie, and she's missing. She's an elderly lady missing, endangered. We need your help now. Can you help? I said, send me the case file. Send me a photo. Send me something. So he did. I'm looking at this lady's photo. Her name's Charlene. And I'm looking at Charlene, and I'm talking to Andy on the phone, and I'm describing rocks and water, and he jumped the gun, and he sent a bunch of police officers down to some creek or something that he thought would be the place, and it wasn't. And then I said, I'll call you back. I'm writing my stuff, and I'm texting him now. And then I said, no, she took a bus, and she ended up in the Bay Area. And there, in the Bay Area, there's a bunch of rocks, and you get into a public area in that way that she crossed over, and so it's like a bridge in that area. Sure enough, now we've got hundreds of police officers all over, looking for helicopters in the sky. And as he describes this in his validation letter in the book during this case, and within an hour of the description I gave, we found Charlene alive in Tampa Bay.
Man. So I've got a question, and I would be remiss if I didn't ask this. What do you do with the cases where you're wrong?
Okay, and I'm trying to find a wrong case, Kevin. Now, that's not being arrogant. It's not being, you know, egotistical. I did a case of a missing child out of Seattle. The detective was very arrogant. This detective was arrogant. Again, here we go. You know, it's not his problem, or it's just the way that police officers are. They see black and white sometimes. And when a new guy comes in on the case, you know, they don't like it. So the mom brought me in. And I said to her, he went through, and this is a really weird family, by the way. You got to, you know, they got tunnels from one house to another. Like, this is a really weird, wacko story, by the way. And the father lost custody of the child, so he decides to go underground and take the child. He takes off, and they're asking me questions. I say, okay, I see him going through Minnesota up into Canada. And the mom goes, okay. And then all of a sudden, she gets a call from somebody that they've been looking for this guy for a while as well. And when you go underground, there are people who hunt you down. They took a picture of him in Quebec, sent it to the mom. She goes, is this in Canada? And she shows me the picture. She goes, because I got somebody sent this to me. And I looked at it, and I said, that's French. That's in Quebec. I see the signs and everything. So she tells the detective wanted nothing to do with this case anymore, or with me on the case, by the way. That's what it meant. And he explained to me how weird this family, both families were. He liked to dress up in women's clothing, and the families were gypsies from over in Czechoslovakia or some place like that over there. They had tunnels under their house, homeschooled people. The mom was a mail order bride or something like this. It's really a wacko story. But the detective didn't want me on the case anymore. I don't understand why, because we actually had validation. He was in Canada, in which I said. So being wrong, I guess that would be the wrong, I guess, looking at it in that perspective. You know, there's been some very high-profile cases I've been on where I've been told to get off because it involved, and we all know in every profession, I want everybody who's listening to this, in every profession, we all know there's good and bad apples in everything, lawyers, doctors, firefighters, and I've sat and put coroners and everybody and got them in hot water with the law, and also police officers. You know, I'm sorry to say, but it is. I got pulled off on a case because of the sex slave trade, and I've gotten actually two people out of the sex slave trade that are in the book, and you can read about it, and they both got home alive. In this, you know, instance, it was a very deep case, involved a lot of individuals back in 1974, have come full circle now, and have prestigious positions in life, who run the city. So I've gotten information, even had the witness come forward from 1974, who had documentation stuffed in her walls all those years, handed it to me, police pull up in my driveway, take it out of the trunk of my car, and all these meetings and taped meetings, by the way. And could I, you know, another thing, good point to everybody out there who gets involved with this, make sure you record everything. Make sure you do everything and keep second and third copies, send them to individuals so you're protected. In the book I wrote too, you know, just a real quick footnote. Read between the lines in this book. It's not only showing you how I solved the case, but it's showing you how. And it's showing you, read between the lines on what proper procedure and doing psychic ability with law enforcement. Because there's a lot of people out there who say, I work with police, and they say they're psychic. They can't prove it. They'll never give a name of a detective to work with. And I started the show saying this. All law enforcement will endorse you. If you solve a case, they're more than happy to bend over and give you a citation or something that proves that you did this. So in saying stopping the, you know, at the end of a case and not solving it, that would probably be one too. It's maddening because we all know who did it, but you can't put them in jail because they run the city. They're like prestigious people now. It's amazing.
Robbie, as a medium, you don't always get the information right. Now, I hear what you're saying, that you don't feel there's been a particular wrong thing, but sometimes mediums, this is my personal view of the case, so please, I totally respect where you are and what you're doing, but sometimes having the wrong information come through, or maybe information that we don't understand, because you know, we don't always understand the information we're getting straight away. Sometimes it takes time to make sense of what spirit is giving to mediums. That can delay cases. That can signal an outcome or finding somebody in. How would you view that?
Good question, Julie. I'm going to look at it outside of the window, not from my perspective of anything I've done, because in anything I've done, in any case, I've never been off or wrong. It's always been on. I have everything documented, which proves it in the book. I mean, I only put 15 cases in that book. Like I said, the book was 400 pages. I had to cut it down. Volume 2 is going to have another 15, and the volume 3 will have another 15. These are all cases with all actual text messages, emails, photographs, everything, letters that contest that, you know, solve the case, everything's done to a T. Outside of that, and looking at the fact that I got asked, and Kevin knows about the Delphi murders in Indiana, I spoke to the mom of Libby, and at the time, you know, it's hard for a mom because her baby was just murdered, but they brought in 15 different psychics, and I got a list sent to me of all these psychics that were on this case. And when you give information to a detective, they have to follow that lead. They have to follow the leads. So when a psychic says, yada, 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 point 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 down to 30 points, they have to follow up everything on there that even if it doesn't make sense, they got to follow it. Then you have like 15 psychics and then all these other people calling and giving tips. And they can look at, and it wastes a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of effort from the police. When I looked at the list of people that were involved, that were handed to me, I couldn't believe it. And there are people on TV, there are people who never done murder cases, but they're known people that we know. And the points that they were given, in my own perspective, which I will not speak about this case unless I'm hired onto this case, is that they're totally off base from what I feel and know that is right in this case. Just ludicrous things. And it's sad to say, but we can't have 50 million people running around saying they're all psychic detectives and they're all got information when they, you know, they only have one case they solved in their whole life and, you know, not even partial. And the reason why I brought the book out, Julie, is to show that you got to have a straightforward baseline of solving case after case after case after case, naming the murderers, naming where they are, where they work. Like Lester Jones, we got a double homicide conviction out of him Christmas of 2016, the 27th of...
The greatest respect, Bobby, the greatest respect. But you're still talking about all of the things that have gone really well and the things that, you know, have been reasonably, you know, quickly solved with good outcomes. But there will always be those times when information that even you as an experienced psychic detective, the information you have might not be the information, or you may not interpret it as the information that you think, and therefore there could be a delay in solving the case.
Well,
I think that's a possibility.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And when we talk about the... on a double homicide in Washington, to two different murder cases. When I said, you know, we went down that road and I felt, but we actually found the other body or somebody else. It's delayed because now we're still looking for Kathleen, but it's really funny. We found the bag with all the flip phones, weapons, you know, clothing. These are items that are in the bag. But we still don't have Kathleen. So now we're still pressed to do that. So in an instance, we got a good partial of the case there. We found somebody else's baby, but we're still missing Kathleen, right? So, yeah, that's a tough one to bite down on, but we're still looking. We got a good portion of it. It eats me. Yeah, it does.
So, having said that, Robbie, what would your advice be? Excuse me, I apologize. What would your advice be to, for example, I'm Joe Layton psychic. Don't know that I have psychic abilities at all. And I'm out mowing my yard. And suddenly I have a vision of a murder and a location of a person that is dead. And that night I see on the news that the police are looking for this murderer. What do I do with that information? How, if I, can't trust myself, what did I just experience, first of all? Second of all, am I really seeing this murder? Third, how do I contact the police about it? I mean, what do you do with that?
I've instructed people in the past, decades ago, who said exactly like what you're saying. Journal everything down, write it down. Don't even, don't exaggerate. What you see, put down precisely what you see. You can go anonymously, as you know, Kevin, and give that tip to the police. They'll have to follow it. Or you can go in person and say, I'd like to speak with the detective and give the information. They're going to have to follow that lead. And we hope that Kevin's tip goes to the point and finds the person that's missing or what happened in that case.
I'm really skeptical about this, guys. I've got to be honest, because I think if somebody, just an average Joe Bloggs, is mowing his lawn and gets a vision and goes to the police, he will become number one suspect.
Not necessarily. There have been people I've spoke with who've given tips, and they said when they went into the police, and I know it's different in Europe than it is here, because they're very more apt not to take advice in Europe. They're very hard. So I've done cases in Ireland, and it was very difficult. But because I got called in with the family, they wanted to help find Joanne. But here, they will look at the individual and say, okay, and they'll run through the parameters of, what were you doing, alibi, stuff like that. Witnesses, you were at home, you weren't. They'll go through their police work knowing that you're not part of this case and take the tip. There's been a lot of people on cases who have given tips and they'll have to follow that tip, but then usually it just goes to garbage. I had a lady from Saskatchewan, and great, good example of Julie, and I'm glad you asked that too, by the way. Victoria Stafford here in Canada went missing. I'm in police talking to Detective Brown, and I'm in with the family, and this lady says, I sent all my information in on via email, but they ignored me. They didn't, well, what they're doing is not ignoring you. They took your information, it didn't need anywhere, so they throw it out. They're not going to get back to you because it's a waste of their time to call you and say, thank you very much. So, people don't realize that. They think they're either being ignored, or if they do come and say, oh my gosh, you got a hit here, we want to speak to you more, they're interested in how you got that information, and maybe they can get more information out of you to give them that vital piece of evidence to move forward, or that little thread that pushes them forward. They're not out to arrest everybody, because if you really realize, when a case happens, like Victoria Stafford, I was there when Rodney, the father, did his lie detector test, and he didn't do too well, but they were trying to blame it on him. But I profiled a man and a woman, and the man and the woman are in jail now, not Rodney. But they look at this stuff, and they know in hindsight, because they're very trained individuals, these police officers, detectives. And they don't just throw salt into the wind and go, okay, well, you're the suspect now. They have a theory, they know what's going on, but they want the outside information, they'll take it from you.
Okay, that's a little bit more reassuring. I don't think it would be, I suppose it's cultural as well, isn't it? And I don't think that would happen so much here, but I see the value in it, obviously, and I think if people have, because many people said after 9/11, didn't they, that they'd had visions, or that they'd had, or your children had done drawings, etc. But of course, it's, hindsight's a wonderful thing.
Absolutely, and like 9/11, that was so powerful. The energy of everything in our world was shook. It involved so many lives, and we're all, I like to say it, genealogically tied through our souls. It's almost like the chemical table, you know, like we're all tied, DNA type thing, and we feel things, we do. And when you said all those, you know, people do these drawings and seen all this, we were hurting. We were all hurting people because this affected everybody.
So, Robbie, before, you know, we're beginning to run a little bit short on time. Now, we've been talking about this book. Why don't you tell the listeners about your book? Where can they get it? I know it's coming out on March the 8th. And under, is it going to be available on Amazon, Books A Million? How can they get in touch with you?
Absolutely. The special signed edition that is only available through my office is on my website, robbiethomas.net. It's going to have bonus material in it where America's Most Wanted film crew filmed me in different shots on scene doing a double homicide with International Police Chief Kevin Smith, the producers from Lamport Shepherd who are from England actually and live in Canada. They have an office there and here. There's a lot of different other photographs of me being on scene with different law enforcement, news clippings, and how they speak of solving crimes and putting people in jail. That's all bonus stuff inside there. There's other bonus material cases that are inside there as well. Now, the one going to Amazon, Books A Million, and in stores is going to be a lesser version, and it won't have all that bonus material. So if you want a signed special edition copy, it's robbiethomas.net, or you can get the other version in the stores coming out very shortly after March 8th.
Well, Robbie, it has been an absolute honor to have you on the show. We're going to have you back when Volume 2 comes out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Where there's some very high for, oh, there's a, really quick, I'll just to tease everybody. This individual was to, when he did appear on America's Got Talent in 2010, his wife was found murdered at the bottom of the Biltmore Hotel landing inside there. I'm working with LAPD on that right now. It's very, very high profile, and it's very dark. So that will be one that will be in the book, and there's a lot more that's going to be in there as well.
Awesome. Well, I look forward to it. The name of the book is Psychic Profiler, The Real Deal, and authored by the psychic profiler himself, Robbie Thomas. Robbie, thank you so much for joining us today.
No, thank you for having me. You guys are a pleasure, and so nice to talk to you guys again.
Welcome to Stephen's True Crime Commentary. Discussions of forensics, how it's done, and true crime interest.
Hello, this is Stephen's True Crime Commentary, and as usual, I am Stephen David Lampley. Welcome back. Listen, I'm going to do something a little different today. I'm going to spend this commentary with the topic of what is it really like being a police officer? There's lots of television shows that try to show or tell, but they fall so short. What I'm about to tell you, you may not hear from the news media. What I'm about to tell you, most police officers won't tell you. I'm about to. So, what's it really like being a police officer? It's one in the afternoon and you begin to get ready for work. It's the same thing most people do before they go to work. You put on your bulletproof vest. As you're putting the vest on, you think of your wife, your kids, and the thought in the back of your mind is, you just may not come home tonight, today. That's the harsh reality of it all. As you secure the bulletproof vest straps, you think quietly to yourself, yes, you may not come home. It's always a possibility. You leave the bedroom and make your way to the den where your spouse and kids are. You give your spouse and kids a kiss and a hug, and it's a different hug than a kiss and a hug than you give when you're going to the store. This hug and kiss could be the last one you will ever be able to give them. Getting in your car, you back out of the driveway and look up at your home. Little hands are waving and blowing you kisses. Your spouse does the same, but you can see the look of concern in her eyes. Even though she tries to hide it, it's still there. You wait back and put the car in drive and begin your trip to the precinct to begin your shift. Your mindset changes as you prepare for the shift ahead. You pass the tree on your way to work. The tree that in the academy they told you to find something on your way to work and on your way home, where on your way home you could drop off everything that happened on your shift and leave it there. So when you go home, you're the husband or the wife that you're supposed to be, and you're not worrying about work and you're not talking about work. You leave everything there. You leave it there. So as you head back to work, you pass the tree and you pick up everything that you left there before. The murders, the homicides, the investigations you're working on, all the things you've seen and heard, you pick back up and take back to work with you. You arrive at the precinct. It's time for roll call. You sit as you listen to the sergeant tell you things that you didn't do that you should have, or things that you did do that you shouldn't have. You'll hear crimes of importance and administrative announcements, and all through it all, you'll hear off-color humor from other officers, maybe even yourself. It's common as a sergeant reads the announcements, with laughter among the officers and sometimes even from the sergeant. Roll call is over, and if you have time, you stand and make small talk with the other officers prior to getting in your car and starting your shift. In your car, you head to your beat. The first pass, you're looking to see how things are now so that if you pass by later and something's different, you'll know something's out of place and may warrant being checked on. You ride, and you ride, and you ride. 8, 10, maybe 12-hour shifts. You'll receive calls on anything and everything you can imagine. Robberies in progress, burglaries, assaults. An elderly lady who has a bat in her bedroom. Loud music complaints, rapes, shoplifters, land disputes. You'll get a call from someone who didn't get the right order at the drive-thru at a restaurant. You'll answer domestic disputes, murders, vehicle collisions, calls on counterfeit money, worthless checks and forgeries, dog barking, neighborhood speeders, flat tires, and the list goes on and on and on. So now you end your shift, relatively uneventful, thankfully. You turn in your paperwork and you head home. You pass that tree going home and you leave what happened during your shift. Hit that tree as always. So what's it really like being a police officer? Being a police officer is knowing that you'll probably never ever vacation in Europe. It's knowing that it's very likely you may need some type of government assistance even to get by. Especially if you have children. The pay is totally inadequate most times. Being a police officer is knowing that you're constantly exposed to hepatitis and HIV and that it's not always possible to protect yourself before the shit hits the fan. It's knowing that police officers have the highest rate of divorce than any other employment group. Being a police officer is knowing that the friends you had before you became a police officer are probably going to alienate themselves from you. You may find that your new friends are other police officers, friends who understand what it is to be a police officer. Being a police officer is knowing that stress is going to eat away at you. Any police officer knows that she is constantly looking around and over her shoulder every minute of the shift. You see, some people like to kill police officers for no other reason than they're police officers. It's knowing that you cannot eat in just any restaurant. The officers who have been at the precinct longer than you know the police-friendly restaurants. The ones who will prepare your food without spitting in it or wiping it on their butts. It does happen. Being a police officer is knowing that even though a spouse in a domestic assault calls you asking for help, he or she may very well turn on you when you start to put the other spouse in jail. being a police officer is having that deep down dread as you're given a call from the dispatcher to deliver a death message to the parents of a teenager. You see, now you have to wake them up at 3:12 in the morning, and you have to be the one to tell them that their 16-year-old daughter's dead. It's knowing that you'll miss a lot of family events like birthdays and Christmas, Thanksgiving, and vacations. It's trying to decide how best to handle a juvenile who has gotten in trouble. Do you try to work with the situation and help them and release them to their parents? Or take them to juvenile? Being a police officer is holding a dying baby in your arms and knowing there's nothing you can do to help. Nothing you can do but cry. Being a police officer is watching another human being burned alive in a house and you cannot get to him. There's nothing you can do. Being a police officer, it's knowing that your career can have a horrible effect on your health and shorten your lifespan. Police are at greater risk of brain cancer, 800% more likely to commit suicide. Police officers are more likely to be depressed. They're more prone to accidental injuries, sleep disorders, weight gain, heart disease. They're more prone to congestive heart failure. The list goes on. That's a short list of what being a police officer is. That's by no means inclusive. But you see, men and women across the world are willing to go out on a limb knowing this and still help in any way they can with the risks that they face every day. And knowing the possible outcome to their families, and knowing the possible outcome to their health. But being a police officer can be an extremely rewarding career. There are times that you can help people that indeed are genuinely happy and thankful that you were there. You can save lives. You can make a difference in people's lives, a positive influence, a positive difference. Men and women across the world know the risks, but yet they still act. Men and women across the world know the risks, and yet they still put on that uniform and come and save you and me. That is all.
Thank you for tuning into Stephen's True Crime Commentary, heard across America. You are invited to visit Stephen's website for information on his books, speaking dates, and speaking programs like How to Catch a Liar. In this seminar, Stephen explains some of the very same techniques police detectives use to help them determine if someone is lying. You will learn such things as global versus individual indicators, use of contractions, voice tone, eye shift, evasion, allusion, pronoun usage, question pause, base shift, and much more. Go to StephenDavidLampley.com for information on his seminar and much more.
Stephen's True Crime Commentary is a production of Something Weird Media and West 53rd Productions, with music by JasonLampley.com.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.